Hello, welcome to the Sober Investor Podcast. My name's Alan McGuire, and with me I have Owen Gilmartin. How's it going, Owen?
Hey, Alan. Good, good. Enjoying the last week or so of August. How about yourself?
I'll be honest. I guess last week, so I spent a lot of time in the pool and I got sunburned. So this week I am basically spending most of the sunlight hours sat in front of my air conditioning on my laptop. And it's pretty miserable because all of my friends have left as well. Like hardly anybody is in Madrid. But I mean, we've got plenty to talk about. I mean, there's the football.
Yeah.
Spanish women's team won the World Cup, the Women's World Cup. Did you watch it, Owen?
I did. Yeah, it was great. I mean, they deserve to win. They were the much stronger team. I mean, England. Yeah. I guess you guys hit the bar in, you know, early on, but after that, it was really all Spain, and yeah, it was great. I mean, they've had an amazing World Cup. When you think they lost 4-0 in their final group game to Japan, you know, they've really come back since then. I just, like, a great team to watch, it's, you know, wonderful football.
I mean, 13 minutes injury time, and then we're actually 40.
Well, that's a bigger issue in football at the moment in general. Yeah. The changes in stopping the clock, etc., they're ruining the game. I mean, it's madness.
Yeah, it was long. I mean, I don't generally watch football. When I moved to Spain, someone said to me, "As long as you're either religious or you like football, then you'll be fine. You'll be able to meet people." And I was like, "Well, I'm not religious and I don't like football, so I'm stuffed." But yeah, I mean, I do like international football, and you know, I was watching it, supporting England. I know it was interesting. It was good. I enjoyed it. Thought England were, yeah, as you said, like after the first sort of 30 minutes, England were just kind of a bit dead in the water, really. And I mean, it was a good game. I was kind of waiting for this wave of like American, Irish, and Scottish criticism on Twitter afterwards. Just all of this kind of different nationalities coming together to congratulate Spain on destroying England.
Yeah, we always enjoy when England loses. I mean, to be honest with you, as long as England loses, I can then acknowledge afterwards that they're a good team. It was the same with the men in the Euros when they got to the final. It was like, yeah, once you don't actually win the competition, I'm happy to recognize you guys play well. But yeah, no, I mean, I think the Spanish team, you know, a lot of interesting stories around the team. Tragic story. I mean, it was sort of an incredible story of Olga Carmona scores the winning goal, dedicates it to, you know, her friend whose parents had just died. And then she found out just afterwards that her father had died, I think it was the previous day or that weekend of the final. I mean, it was pretty incredible. I guess the emergence of new stars, people like Salma Baracuellos, you know, an incredible player, scored the winner against the Dutch, you know, in the quarters. And then, of course, like in the center, Bon Mati, another Barca player. Barca dominated the team. So no, I mean, they were a great team to watch. I really enjoyed it. Obviously, that is where the emphasis needs to be. You know, I think Spanish women's football has come so far. A lot of these players were involved in the strike in 2019 to try and improve paying conditions, fighting for a collective agreement that would at least have sort of the minimum conditions that the men would have in their professional league. And
I mean,
yeah,
like 19, they were asking for 19, like minimum wages, effectively.
I mean,
right?
Basically, yeah.
It's like 90 grand a year. So they can get access to payment if they ever, you know, get injured or fall pregnant. I mean, and they were basically told it wasn't viable. And then 4 years later, they go on to win the World Cup. I mean, it's just, it's madness, right?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, and you see, you know, like there's, you know, the domestic league has really, like, you know, really grown in the last few years to the point where Real Madrid now have their own team after sort of, you know, ignoring women's football for a long time.
It's a very male-dominated game. And I think it's the perfect kind of example of this is the controversy that happened during the celebration on the pitch was when the head of the Spanish FA, a football association, Luis Rubiales, kissed Jenny Hermoso without consent. So, you know, they hugged. A celebratory hug. He put both of his hands on the side of her head and kissed her on the lips without consent. Then later on, during I think it was an Instagram live kind of celebration in the change room, she was asked about this kiss because it had been caught on national television. And she was like, well, obviously I didn't like it.
And so I think said something about what can I do or something.
Like, yeah, yeah. Like, what can I do? I didn't like it. You know, it's kind of, it has eclipsed the win when you think about it in terms of press, sadly.
But it is an interesting story in that sense, because I was watching this morning on ITV, was it yesterday? I think they had a segment on it, and then what's his name? Richard and Judy, what's his second name? Richard Madley, whatever his name is. He was saying, but the Continentals love kissing. You know, they were trying to slightly dismiss it, right, as in, you know, it was a really nasty, nasty power play about, you know, like, he never would have treated a male player like that.
No.
And probably constitutes a criminal offence.
I mean, and so that's the thing, right? I mean, the response has been pretty big. I mean, Sumar came out and asked for him to stand down immediately. And also, you know, he basically gave a half-assed apology getting off the plane. And he basically said in this apology that was just filmed on like a camera phone, he basically just says, you know, if I have offended you, then I apologize. Like, yeah, basically, if you've taken offense.
The classic non-apology. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And then Pedro Sanchez is effectively, you know, when asked about it at a press conference, what he thinks about it, he's effectively said, well, you know, I don't think the apology is good enough. I think you need to keep on trying. So, you know, there has been quite a big political response to this. And, you know, obvious outrage on social media from different sections of Spanish society. I suppose the most interesting one was probably the former Equality Minister, René Montero, from Podemos.
Still acting Equality Minister.
Still acting, okay. But she said, like, you know, this is an act of gender violence or sexual violence. I can't remember her exact term, that women face every day. And that kind of plays into something that I often end up talking to my wife about. It's quite interesting. You know, the standard Spanish greeting for women and men is kind of, you know, men kiss women, and men shake hands, and women kiss women. But a lot of, you know, kind of an ongoing thing in Spanish feminism is women don't like kissing men they don't know. Like, and it's...
particularly in a professional setting. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, obviously, that kiss, I mean, it was basically her boss kissed her on the lips. I mean, you know, what... Like, you know, he is the president of the Football Federation, and then the Football Federation releases a statement in her name, which you know she did not write, but yeah, you're right. I've had that conversation with a lot of friends and people I know, and like, yeah, they don't, you know, a lot of particularly younger women, and I'm sure women of all ages don't like the fact that in professional settings they are often expected to do the two kisses with male colleagues. You know, it's not one thing is with, you know, in a group of friends, and I think, particularly after COVID, that has come back.
Didn't she also, though, refuse to go on camera with him as well? I mean,
yes.
I mean, it is kind of, this is how, it's not that the media have blown this out of proportion and she's like very quiet about it. I mean, she's effectively refused to be on camera with him as well, right? And then I suppose the other big news story is the investiture. So, Owen, do you want to tell us? You're the man to explain what's going
on. yeah, God's. As we were talking before, Adam, I'm so sick of Spanish electoral politics at the moment. But yeah, yesterday the king chose the PP leader, Alberto Núñez Feijóo, as the candidate to be voted in the Spanish Parliament as prime minister. He has no chance of actually really winning a majority of votes in the Spanish Parliament. But the reasoning behind the king's decision was that this is precedent that normally the party with the most seats is the party that gets the first chance to form a government. Yeah, I mean, I think we'll see what happens. The logic of Feijóo pushing for this vote seems to be to try and reduce the time that Pedro Sanchez has to negotiate with the Catalan nationalists, etc. His vote, I think, or his investiture vote will be September 26th, 27th. And then Sanchez will have 2 months after that to form a government, or else we're heading towards new elections straight after the Christmas break. I think it's, you know, a week after Reyes or something like that. Something like that. Yeah, exactly. So we'll either end up with a new government in November or repeat elections in January. I still think there's going to be a government, a deal will be done between Junts per Catalunya and Pedro Sanchez. Maybe some form of amnesty will have to be given to those involved and persecuted by around the Catalan independence push in 2017. But let's see.
Yeah, I mean, there's just lots of noise at the moment, right? I mean, there's journalists, I think, bored because nothing's happening in August. Well, there's plenty happening, but there's plenty of journalists pushing different lines. I saw one earlier that was like some of the more right wing PSOE deputies from Castilla La Mancha kind of support FICO.
Well, that is one of the theories, isn't it? But these lists were handpicked by Pedro Sanchez. You know, there's I think the idea that there's going to be six or seven socialist MPs that will do a Tamayaso, I think, is not going to happen. But yeah, look, I'm really looking forward to your interview. Can you?
Yes, it's basically on trying to read Al-Andalus like you would read Greek history. So, teaching it in a different way, teaching the legacy of Al-Andalus in regards to poetry, philosophy, and architecture, rather than looking at, you know, this battle happened here, this battle happened here, like reading it as a legacy, as opposed to, you know, reading it just historic as linear history.
Wow, so yeah, interesting. Yeah, so part of the I guess, yeah, cultural, poetic, and philosophical legacy of Spain. I mean, it has to be incorporated within the canon and such.
And that kind of way of actually overcoming this kind of division as seeing, you know, that period of time as like the other part of
history. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so Spanish history begins with the fall of Granada or whatever, like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I think it's an interesting approach, and I hope people enjoy it.
Great.
With me today, I have Mahmoud Rushdie, who is a writer and translator and a PhD candidate in comparative studies in literature and culture. So joining me from LA as well, by the way. So thank you very much. I know there's a big time difference. So welcome to Sobremesa.
Thank you so much, Alan, for your invitation. I'm glad to be here.
So today we're talking about Al-Andalus. Al-Andalus is very, very big issue in Spain. I think there's kind of, you know, if you go down to Andalusia, you still see loads and loads and loads of the remnants of this, you know, a very different culture. But also you see it in like the language and stuff, in Spanish language, like my favorite word, ojalá, is from Arabic.
Yeah.
So, Mahmoud, why are you doing a PhD on this? And tell us a bit about your project and your connection to this.
So, yeah, so thank you so much for the question. I want to clarify first, like my main dissertation project or PhD project is not about Al-Andalus, is mainly between the Arab world and Latin America.
Uh-huh.
I try to read and understand the concept of apocalypse between the Arab world and Latin America. And I try to investigate this this concept and this genre in literature, film, and photography. So my relationship with Spanish is for my leaning toward understanding what I call common predicaments between these two huge regions. Each one of them has a common language. They are vast in area, and they have their own history, but also this history is very attached to a Western power in a way or another. So this is how my relationship comes to Spanish as a language. For Andalus is for me a very personal passion in many ways. The story goes back, one of the layers of the story goes back to last summer. There is a project, there is a funding in my university to go to study Spanish in Spain. And I was lucky to get the funding and I went there last summer. It was my first time in Spain, my first time in Andalusia. I was studying Spanish in Universidad de Granada over summer. And from it was like a fascinating moment. Like from the moment I arrived the place, I felt as if, oh my God, ojalá, I have been here before. I'm sure I lived here before. There's something makes you feel deeply attached to the place, at least in my case. And as much as I spend time there, as much I found this attachment like much deeper. So that made me feel that, I want to see the other cities in Andalusia, in southern Spain. So, and it made this like, I was like a fever man, moving from Cordoba to Tarifa, from Almeria to Cadiz. And as much as I move around Andalusia, as much I feel the attachment is stronger. And there's something also about the people there that made me feel this kind of warmth, reminded me as if I am walking in Alexandria in Egypt, where I am from, but in Spanish, not in Arabic, you know?
Yeah.
This kind of attachment and the relationship with the place, the immediate, it's something what Spinoza called affect. So you feel the attachment without really understanding it quite comprehensively. Mm. And you need time. You understand it retroactively. You understand it retrospectively in many ways. So this is a layer of the attachment with the place. The other layer is about Al-Andalus itself as a legacy. This 800 years you mentioned of the Arabs in the Iberian Peninsula. And Al-Andalus as a history, as a legacy, has been present in the public imagination around of the people around what we call the Arab world. And when we say something like the Arab world, we don't mean it in an ethnic or race way, but we mean that Arabic as a language is the dominant language from the Atlantic Gulf, Morocco, Mauritania, to the Arab, from the Atlantic Ocean, sorry, to the Arab Gulf, Qatar and Bahrain. So that Andalus has been really deeply like present, like novels and poetry and even...
How is it portrayed in the Arabic world?
Yeah, there is a discourse around that. There's the mourning and lamenting the loss of Al-Andalus, because it was considered in many ways the peak of the Islamic civilization, one of the peak moments of the Islamic civilization. And of course there has been a misuse of this legacy, of this peak of the Islamic civilization, like that was because of Islam. But also it is not just because of Islam, because Islam has been in other places and it was not the same result. So there's something much more complicated, much more deeper here. So being like being from Egypt and grow up with this discourse, with this legacy around you all time, you tend to distance yourself from it. You tend to be a little bit suspicious about this discourse. Don't take it directly and think about it in a different way, because this is how I think about it, with all what the Arabs and Muslims accomplished in Andalus, in many ways they were colonizers. So you cannot take this out of the equation. But they were colonizers as a part. Here the historical context is very important. They were colonizers as a part of an Islamic empire that in its time, it was imitating the other empires around it, like Persia and Byzantium. So how they were imitating by expanding.
Yeah.
It's a historical context. Every empire at that moment was doing the same thing. So, yeah, so this is how I think of it, like how to be aware of these layers, how not to take just one side, and how to have all the elements of the discourse or the history in your mind so you can maintain a kind of personal perspective and that could give you the chance to understand the other, not just yourself.
I suppose it's like, as well, seeing it in contrast within context to the time. I mean, as well, I think the interesting thing about Al-Andalus in the Spanish-speaking world and also the English-speaking world to a degree is it's often portrayed as kind of like, you know, the other, I suppose. You know, this sort of like alien force, the you know, the them, not us, you know, kind of like the dividing thing. And it's very much like, even today, just outside of Toledo, there is a theme park called Puerto de Fort. It's a French theme park, but the Spanish version. And basically what it is it's kind of like a historical reenactment for families. It's a theme park where they have lots of rides and things like this. Spectacular shows, fireworks. You can go and spend the whole day there. There is a French version as well. But even there, you know, very much the, you know, Al-Andalus is kind of seen as the other, is, you know, not Christian, not Catholic, you know, very other. It's, so it still maintains that kind of. And do you think, like the way that it's taught as well, I mean, it's taught as history, is very, you know, it's 800 years, almost a century of the Iberian Peninsula as a landmass, but also as a changing society. It's very much taught as, you know, the reconquest of Spain. Yeah. A lot of people frame it as the reconquest of Spain. That's apparently also, you know, contested because, you know, what were they actually reconquering it or were they just conquering it? Because they weren't there before to conquer it, a lot of people would argue. I mean, that's probably an argument for another podcast. But anyway, I think, you know, there are lots of really hot debates around how it's taught and how it's approached, because it is, you know, two very distinct civilizations. Yeah. Well, distinct, that's another argument, I'm sure. But two very different civilizations, two different religions, obviously, as well, occupying, you know, the same landmass. So what's your kind of approach to teaching, and what do you think about some of these debates at the moment?
Yeah, this is a very important question, I think. And when I talked about maintaining a distance from the Arab discourse on Al-Andalus and mourning the loss of Andalus, I also mean to maintain a distance from the Spanish discourse of that's just centered around the Reconquista, and ignoring and neglecting intentionally the richness of this 800 years. And of course, religion plays a huge role in this kind of thing. Like, if this 800 years were by the Romans, for example, your treatment to it would be completely different, right? So this is how I'm thinking about that. We need a different kind of reading and understanding of the legacy of Al-Andalus. I keep emphasizing on the notion of the legacy, the richness. And I think one of the ways, because you cannot just be stuck in the historical reading. The historical reading would take you to a conflict that no one will win in any way. So what I think of usually is, how can we read Al-Andalus collectively? How can we read Al-Andalus and teach Al-Andalus as we teach the Stoics, as we teach the Greek philosophy? With the Stoics, with the Greek philosophy, we do not follow every concept they supposed, they suggested. We do not follow every idea they thought of. We read them selectively to understand their position in the history of the human intellect, and to understand their genuine ideas in and concept in that moment, at that time. So I here in the American Academia, for example, we have general education, what we call general education class, introduction level, where students from every discipline take the same class in many ways. And so I think of there is a kind of need to teach, this is what I'm suggesting, to teach Al-Andalus the same way we teach the Greek philosophy and the Stoics in this general education level, and to give people the chance to read this legacy in a different way, with being less attached to the historical conflict and emphasizing more on the cultural production of this 800 years. And I think that the great benefit of such a way, the selective reading of the legacy, is that you challenge the two discourses. You challenges the Arab-Muslim mourning or the loss of Andalus, and also it, because you just select things. You don't follow everything.
Mm.
And you challenge the Spanish Reconquista position by emphasizing that, look, it is 800 years. You cannot run away from your own history.
Yeah, yeah.
You need to engage with it. You need to read it. You need to selectively understand it. And because this is something unfortunately happened in Spain. And I have very good friends in Andalusia, and I met in Madrid, and they all agree on the progressive of them agree on that. Like, Spain tends to turn its back to its history. It has this kind of tendency. So when you suggest, okay, I'm not going to talk about Reconquista, I'm not going to talk about the greatness of Islam, I am going to read the production, the culture production of this culture, of this civilization, selectively, the same way you, in the Western tradition, read the Stoics and the Greek.
Yeah.
It's very important. And you can think of it. And when I think of this kind of selective reading, I tend to structure it around three dimensions. Poetry, and we can talk about that later in detail if you want. Poetry, philosophy, and architecture.
Mm.
In what I call, so this is what the title of the class, as I suggest, as I think of, Al-Andalus, poetry, philosophy, architecture in Islamic Spain. And I mean, what I mean by Islamic Spain, not Muslim Spain, because I also want to emphasize on the role of the Jewish intellect in this society.
Yeah.
That happened to be under an Islamic empire in that moment of history, that allowed the Iberian Jews to flourish in many ways. Of course, there were limitations. With no doubt, and something we can talk about. But again, there is something in the history itself you cannot just ignore.
Yeah. About
their contribution.
So, I mean, we'll go on to the politics, philosophy, and architecture in a bit, because I think that is kind of key. But also, Stoics in Silicon Valley have, you know, seen a massive boom in the last 10 years. Lots of reprints and reinterpretations and things. To, you know, try and apply these lessons and principles to what is, you know, chaotic modern life. But also, I think what fascinates me, I think, mostly about, Islamic Spain is kind of or the fact that, you know, three cultures were able to flourish together. Which is something that I think a lot of, you know, I think most people, progressive people at least, that probably listen to this podcast would agree is something we definitely need to re-envision today. I mean, given the huge migrant crisis, the huge refugee crisis, people drowning in the sea and, you know, horrendous crimes against humanity, really. What legacy do you think can be brought out of these three sort of three cultures that manage to sort of live together?
Yeah. So very very important question. Of course, just before going to this kind of three dimensions of three folds, I'm thinking about poetry, philosophy, and architecture. We can just mention something about the idea of co-living and the concept of co-living. And for example, Cordoba, or as we say in Arabic, Cordoba, for 100 years, it was considered the first cosmopolitan city in Europe. It was the only place in Europe that you can find Muslims, Christians, and Jews living together. And retroactively, it was historicized as the convivencia, as they say it in Spanish. And of course, the concept of convivencia has its own limitation because it wasn't equal rights to everyone.
Uh-huh.
But again, you need to go back to that moment and to understand the historical situation. When you think of this idea, the only city in all Europe where you can find the three religions living together, we're in that place for 100 years. This is not a little amount of time, right? So in many ways, this convivencia with all its own limitation, it was a revolutionary way of living when you think about it.
Uh-huh.
So what can we get from that? How can we think about that? How can we, again, selectively read this legacy, this moment, and take from it something that could be helpful for us in our moment? Because, again, when you think about the U.S., it is not the perfect system. It is not the greatest, the most, like, the ideal place you would look for. But it is considered the highest democratic state in our history, with all its faults, with all its problems, with the issues with racism, with the issues of discrimination, with the inequality, with neoliberal capitalism, with all of that, you still consider the U.S. as the highest form of governance in the human history, in its historical context. Maybe 200 years, you will laugh on that. But you will need to go back and understand that in its historical context. So this is something I just wanted to emphasize on. Here, poetry, philosophy, and architecture are, for me, not a way to exclude other disciplines, but it is, I can think of them as a well-layered ground that might allow us to think with and to go beyond them. So for poetry, for example, is like, when I say poetry, I think of prose and music and dancing, and how the Andalusian Muwashshah, the Arabic poetry of Al-Andalus, Al-Muwashshahat, as we say it in Arabic, was a profound encounter between the Arabic poetry and Andalusian landscape and the gypsy music, which will develop after that something like the flamenco, for example. Poetry, when poetry flourishes in a particular period and place, that can tell you something about the relationship between the people of that place and that time and their own language. Poetry in Arabic, as we consider it, the highest form of engagement with language. And Andalus had like numbers, like long list of some of the greatest poets in the history of Arabic poetry. And it's a 1500-year tradition, 1,500-year tradition of poetry.
Wow.
Yeah. So and you have in this 800 years, you had Ibn Zaydun, you had Ibn al-Khatib, you had Ibn Bajjah, what they call in Latin, Avembes. So their poetry is still recomposed in songs until today. For philosophy, you can think of philosophy as we think of it, like it is the highest form of abstract thinking. So again, that could tell you something. When philosophy flourishes in a place, that could tell you something about the relationship between of the people of that place and abstract thinking. And when we think about philosophy, I really want to emphasize that, not to think about it in the terms of an Western academia analytic philosophy, but philosophy in Al-Andalus was an encounter. Again, it's a place of encounters. So philosophy was in an encounter between the Greek philosophy, Islamic theology, what we call in Arabic ilm al-kalam, and translation, because you translated the Greek philosophy into Arabic. And someone like Averroes, for example, Ibn Rushd, had his own explications, actually. Like, the literal translation shouldn't be explanations, should be explications. It's the shuruhat. Aristotle, explications of Aristotle. So So, and from this encounter of Islamic theology, Greek philosophy, and translation, you had something like the Islamic mysticism in the Western Islamic mysticism, and we call it Western because it's the Western of the Islamic Empire.
Right. Okay.
Right. So, just people wouldn't get confused. It's the Western of the Islamic Empire at that time. And it was different from Islamic Sufism in the Eastern Islamic Empire in Persia and Central Asia. And you have in Al-Andalus, you have one of the greatest minds of all time in all history, Ibn Arabi, for example, who in one of his books, I think, Fusus al-Hikam, the Stone Rings of Wisdom, he mentions Plato and calls him the divine Plato, but he criticizes him for following the human logic, not his divine intuition. So do you see this kind of engagement with the other, right? Mm. And also you have Ibn Tufayl, the author of Hayy ibn Yaqban, which could be considered a proto-novel, something that when you look at it retroactively, okay, Robinson Crusoe actually followed Hayy ibn Yaqban and made it in a Western way, but Hayy ibn Yaqban was this proto-novel of putting the Islamic mode of philosophy, of thinking, in questioning the cosmos and the existence and what do we mean to be here as a field. The last part of this, like the last side of this triangle architecture for me is really, really important for many reasons. Well, the first reason is it's an embodiment. Architecture, when we say architecture, it's an embodiment of so a long spectrum of fields, mathematics and urban design, civil engineering, statics, religion, and philosophy. So the people of that place, they were not just immersed in an engagement with pure language or engagement with pure abstract way of thinking with poetry or philosophy, but they had this kind of what I keep calling a deep engagement with the earthly body of the place, the landscape of Andalusia. And we have, until today, as you mentioned in the introduction, we have four great cities of Al-Andalus: Cordoba, Sevilla, Granada, and Toledo. And the fascinating thing about the landmarks, the Islamic landmarks in these places, is that as much as you notice patterns and resemblances in the Islamic architecture, they are still deeply different. They are still deeply unique. So La Mesquita in Cordoba is really different from Al-Ambra in Granada, and they are both different from La Giralda in Seville, and all of them are different from the synagogue of Santa Maria La Blanca in Toledo. So how can you, the synagogue that inside it has the Islamic art,
wow,
right? So how can you think about it? So it wasn't just the Jews had their own things inside the Islamic sphere. No, things were really merged. They were in a deep conversation with each other. So Jews read Arabic poetry and Arabs translated from Greek and Latin and Hebrew. So how can you think about that? How can you understand this kind of richness that it can show itself in this architecture? Because all of the Islamic architecture is filled with written with Arabic writings, right?
Yeah.
So the writing is as if you are making the body of the architecture embodies your own poetry and your own philosophy. So this is how I think about this. This are the three parts of the legacy that we need to teach selectively, as if we are teaching like the Stoic legacy or the Greek philosophy legacy.
And if you had to explain the legacy of Al-Andalus to somebody today, how would you go about describing that?
So I Here I may need to mention two great academics and scholars, Eric Calderwood and Christina Cervantes. They, for me, like my teachers, my virtual teachers through their work, through their books in the English-speaking academia. And like, for example, Christina Cervantes calls it the afterlives of Al-Andalus. She traces the Arabic as the Andalusian legacy in Arabic and in Latin Hispanic narrative. And see how through the literature, through the writings of the others, the people after that time, you can think of the relationship, how to relate to that place. Eric Calderwood call it the many lives of Al-Andalus. So Christina Cervantes call it the afterlives, and Eric Calderwood would call it many lives. But in both cases, it's very helpful to think of that time with a mental practice to put the religious issue aside and to engage with the content of this culture. What did they produce? And one of the suggestions, for example, I think of that the Islamic philosophy, especially in Al-Andalus, cannot be separated from the Western philosophy. Islamic philosophy is a fundamental part of the Western philosophy, not just because of the translation of the Greek and the preservation of the Greek philosophy that will come through Arabic in Al-Andalus and go back to Latin by translation after Reconquista. It is not just about this kind. It wasn't just a preservation, but it was a place and time where, for the first time, someone like Averroes in his way and Ibn Arabi in his way tries to reconcile between the Greek philosophy and your theological discourse, which is something will be tried after that, like someone like Kierkegaard, for example, would try to do it between Christianity and Greek philosophy. So how can we think about that? And the mode of thinking, the mode of building, when you look at the how the Andalusians thought about water, the place of water in place, how to build by preserving privacy, but also by showing the beauty of the aesthetics at the same time. So these are ways to think about the legacy of Andalus, I think. We can look at the influence of Andalusian architecture in Latin America, in Cuba, for example. Or we can look at the legacy of Andalus as it's influencing Arabic poetry. Mahmoud Darwish has a massive poem.
I read the Stoics some time ago now, way before COVID. I probably did me some good during COVID. But, you know, I was kind of reading it, kind of thinking, you know, I've seen this. It's just, like, I know, like, I kind of know this, but it's cool to read it. That's people who read it. People have been saying it for millennia, but also kind of like it helps you put things in a different perspective or helps you understand why you think something. Yeah. And it's like kind of like you see through your own thoughts, the kind of the line of thought all the way back from the Stoics. Is there, like, what are some modern day examples, both culturally but also thought wise, of Al-Andalus in kind of the modern day?
Yeah, so I can think of something I have been listening to in the last few weeks, a collaboration between the flamenco singer Estrella Morente and the Moroccan oud player Jalal Shukara, and they have with the Andalusian band from Amsterdam. So they were making this kind of collaborative musical staging where concerts where Jalal sings in Arabic with Moorish music, Estrella Morente sings in Spanish with flamenco, and the music behind them is a mix between Arab and Andalusian instruments in many ways. So you get this kind of feeling that it's like a soup. So mixed that you cannot really separate one of the other.
Uh-huh.
And this kind of moment of collaboration really helpful. Okay, this is what I mean by the legacy, because legacy is different from legacy is different from history.
Yeah, totally.
Legacy is a way of reading the recorded history. It's a critical way of reading the recorded history. One of the other things, for example, I'm thinking about is how, going back to Cordoba, like for 100 years, it was the capital of the Umayyad Caliphate in the Iberian Peninsula, the Andalus, and how at the time, Cordoba was famous by having women scientists, for example.
Oh, wow.
Alimat Cordoba, as we say it in Arabic. And this legacy is so important. It's so important for people around the Arab world. So important of thinking of the woman as the other, as an equal other, not less than equal in any sense. This is something very important to inspire our way of living around the Arab world, but not just the Arab world. Because by being here in the US and traveling around different places, I can see that the issue with equal treatment of women is actually a worldwide thing. It's a global issue. So this is something we can keep in our mind. Also, another example I'm thinking about is there is a book by one of the Andalusian poets and theologians, Ibn Hazm, and it's called The Ring of the Doll, Tawq al-Hamama, and it's a love book, it's a romance book. And until today, this book has been translated actually to so many languages. Until today, this book can be very, very inspiring in how we can love, how you love. You love in the Sufi way, the love to, if you believe to your God, or the love to your lover. And this kind, I feel this kind of way of thinking, this way of writing, very refreshing. It's like as if you are getting a fresh air in the heart of this machinery world. Maybe I will not take everything from that book. Maybe I will not. I will think like some places are too emotional for me, or too magical realist for me, especially for the time we are living now. But also, let this kind of current of water to go through you, and it will leave something. You will get something from its remains. So I think there are many ways, and I, as much, because I cannot claim that just one person can teach the legacy of Al-Andalus in the best way. I also want to emphasize on the need to have different ways of teaching the legacy of Al-Andalus. So the legacy itself, as a way of reading, as a way of teaching, to have different ways of teaching it. And as much as we have this kind of way of teaching, as much we will find ways to engage with it, as find ways to inspire our daily life with it, the same way we think of the Stoics or the same way we think of the Greeks, in many ways. And I know there are difficulties, I know there are some obstacles, because, for example, Arabic today is not an organic language of Spain or Latin America, and Spanish is not an organic language around the Arab world. The relationship is different. The two languages is different from, for example, French between Algeria and France. It's a different, really, right? It's a different relationship. So because of this, you need a double labor from the scholars. You need people who really want to do the labor and go to the other and expose yourself to the other. And as much as we can do this, as much we can learn, because you cannot just send 800 years to oblivion because of a religious dimension without being able to see the so many other layers of dimension, the so many lives of the other dimension.
Do you think as well, sorry, I know you said my last question was the last one, but no, also, you know, this kind of way of approaching it, it's kind of a way of not just Spain, obviously, but Portugal as well, but, you know, of making some kind of peace with the history of Spain during, or the peninsula during this time. I mean, there are lots of, they're not shared that widely, but there are lots of kind of Hispanic Arabic relation, like committees and groups and things, and they do reenactments and things like this, and they do marches and stuff. But it's very small, like it's not big.
I think this kind of communities, this kind of even reading clubs are quite important, because I was like exchanging some messages with a friend who is working on Averroes, the work of Averroes, and we were talking about how like this kind of edges, what we call edges, places where there are edges, is where a thought can flourish, is where you can challenge a kind of pattern. I'm aware of like there is an intensity around the migration from the south of the Mediterranean to the north of the Mediterranean.
Uh-huh.
And this kind of historical conflict between Christianity and Islam in many layers. But also, again, all of this are more reasons to have this kind of spots, this kind of places, this kind of ways of engagement that challenges the public discourse, the public imagination, make some kind of disturbance in a positive way, affect, a Spinozian affect in the positive way. And again, the Arabs around the Arab world, or the Muslims, or whatever, how you want to call it, need to, as much as they are proud of their legacy of their civilization in Al-Andalus, they want to be aware of this underlying that you were colonizers, and the Spanish, as much as they are proud of the Reconquista and getting Spain back, you need to be aware of the massive contribution of the civilization for 800 years in your own history. Like, for example, I cannot remember the name of the king now, but the one who conquered Toledo, when he entered Toledo. And this is like something written in the records of the recordings of the time. He was really shocked, like as if you bring someone from a wild place to the heart of New York. Like, how can I manage that?
Yeah.
Right? How can I manage all of that? So you need also to be aware of that, and not just in terms of architecture or the complex layers of governance at that time, but also what the philosophy of that time gave you. You wouldn't have an access to the Greek philosophy without that. It's like, this is a very simple historical fact. So you cannot turn your back to it and say, no, I will not look at it. Right. So we need to, this is how it's important to challenge this kind of discourse from the two sides. From the two sides, and it's much easier for someone who is not engaging in it from one of the two sides. It's much easier to appreciate the good thing from the two sides. And maybe also this is a place from which you can get something different to add to all of this discourse. So again, this is why the legacy of Al-Andalus shouldn't be just occupied in teaching by Arabs or just by Spanish, but actually you need some people from outside. It's the same way I go to Latin America as a scholar. I'm Egyptian. Arabic is my mother tongue. I study in the U.S. and Spanish is my third language. And this is what I call, you declare the politics of your location and you go to the other, showing your vulnerability and showing that you are not claiming any kind of expertise. You are coming to learn. And I think these kind of encounters are so important to make any kind of research valuable.
Yes, definitely. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Of course. Thank you so much. I'm so glad to get the chance to talk about such a topic. And thanks for your generosity for asking me to be here.